Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Good to have you with us. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper, recovering from his serious back injury, but is doing much better and is planning his return. So we're excited about that. Well, today we continue our series, our new series on Topical Currents, All in a Day's Work. The series was conceived of and produced by Peter J. Meritz. And in these programs, we're looking at a day in the life of all kinds of workers who we know are out there, but generally don't think about too much. Our aim is to get insights into the jobs and what it takes to perform them. And an important note is we're focusing on the individuals and their commitment to their occupations and our workforce, but we're not here to discuss the political, social, or economic ramifications of the jobs. We just want to hear from you. We welcome your questions, but not opinions about the organizations for whom they work. So you're welcome to voice those comments on our website or Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. So joining us is recently retired airline captain Bruce Borenstein. Welcome. Thanks for joining us in our new series.
Hello, Bonnie. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you with us. I was thinking first to describe the status or image of a pilot when you were growing up.
I remember growing up and in high school, I met a captain at the time who was actually a handball player at the Y and Institute where I went with my dad. And he was bigger in life and he played a dramatic role in getting me started and enthused to focus my career in joining, eventually getting on with a major carrier.
Did you admire him for, when you say he was bigger than life, what was, you know, and what year are we talking about?
Oh, that would be in the early 70s. I was maybe 16, 17 years old at the time, and I never met anybody who was a living airline pilot or captain at the time, so it was like meeting Santa Claus.
Okay, so you meet him and you say, that's what I want to do. What was, like, what happened?
Well, yes, I actually had that in mind before, but had no structure or focus how I was to go about endeavoring to go the path and become an airline pilot. So many ways to do it.
And what did your parents think? I mean, your father evidently knew this guy, introduced you to him. What did they think? And what did your friends think when you said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pursue this.
Well, it's interesting. My parents were not actually very thrilled with me flying. They had obvious concerns at the time of safety and would want me to do something else that they consider more traditional. However, I had kept this to myself quite a bit, but the certain friends I had at the time encouraged me, and nonetheless, you know, I pursued it in the best way I could.
And it's funny that you say, you know, something safer, because at the time in the 70s, flying was pretty safe, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, you're right about that. But when you start, we're not starting at airline level. We're starting with some very basic training, and it's on a much different or smaller scale.
Right, right. Okay, we're going to get to that. Before we do, how many years did you fly, and which years were they?
I actually joined the airline beginning of 1979 up until 2012, which I took an early retirement.
Okay. And that's because...
I actually had a mishap with a bicycle accident and a shoulder injury that resulted in my not being able to perform my duties safely.
Mm-hmm. How ironic that you flew for all those years and it was a bike accident. You know. Yeah. Okay. So you flew international flights as well as domestic, transcontinental?
Yes, I did. When I started out, I was doing mostly domestic within North America. But maybe within 2 years, when I trained on the wide body, that was my first introduction to go overseas. And I remember my first flights to London and Paris.
Now, you weren't in the military, were you?
No, I wasn't.
So how unusual was it for someone who wasn't in the military to become a pilot?
That's a good question. Where I came from and growing up, it was difficult to get into the military because there wasn't much offered in a sense that would train me to lead me into become into the airline profile. So I attended colleges. I attended a 2-3 year technical program that basically got me into ab initio training, and pursued it from that.
Well, let's go through the training. Were you at a disadvantage because you weren't in the military?
At the time, I thought maybe I was missing out. But as it turns out, time-wise in the end, it seems like everybody met at the same time when they were ready to be looked upon by the airlines in their interviews. So it was a reasonable amount of time.
Okay, take us through the training. What did it entail in terms of this education? You went to two schools, and how many years was that?
After high school, I went to college. That was an aviation flight technology program of 3 years. They had led me through the basic academics, provided initial flight training, and then after I was finished and graduated, I then went to into the I guess we just call it into the regular field that's non-military and had nothing to do with college, just to get my hands and feet in the ground, if you will, and start out with just some basic refueling. I would look after airplanes, and at the time there were charter companies in there, and I had made contacts with them and eventually started to do a bit of flying for them.
So that's how you started, with charter airlines?
Yes, they weren't really airlines, but they're just charter companies.
And how many hours did you have to accrue? Is that how you got most of your hours?
Well, Bonnie, it works that in the sense that your licensing required so many hours, but your employers a lot of times demanded that you had a certain amount of experience. You would have to have so many thousands of hours, but you really had to have the licenses in order to be considered to be hired for that certain job.
And what are the physical requirements? Are they strenuous?
No, I don't think they're strenuous. I think at the time, most people figured that if you had any eye impairment, that would have restricted you definitely from being hired or looked at by an airline. But today, that's totally different. It's all correctable now. You'd be amazed.
Really? So, okay, back then, you couldn't wear corrective lenses? You had to have 20/20 vision?
At the time I applied, yes. That was the rule. So I was lucky to have my 20/20.
Wow. And now it's okay. Now you can get surgery, wear lenses, wear contact lenses, wear
absolutely
glasses.
You can have hearing impairments and even beyond that. So as long as it's within the confines of the company medical rules.
Why do you think that changed?
Technology, I would say. And, of course, I think human rights had a big role to play in that, because they were keeping a lot of people out who definitely were qualified but overlooked.
So maybe Americans with Disabilities Act had something to do with it? Okay. I was thinking also, why were there any women applicants when you were doing it, applying and training?
They just began. In fact, my initial course, we had two or three women in our group, our class. About, I think we had 26, 27 people. So there's a bit of a focus on them at the time. And today's standards, nobody even pays attention anymore.
But it's still, I don't usually see women pilots.
There are many. Probably the only place you will see them, observe them, is walking through the terminals.
Right.
So, but they've been in Russia, they've been probably in the industry well since the 50s.
In Russia?
In Russia, yeah.
And most of them were, I don't know if they were in the military.
Well, I think the only way that they were able to pursue their careers was through the military.
Oh, okay.
But this eventually came over in North America, adopted the, both sexes can do the same job.
Yeah. Did you always want to be a commercial pilot, or did you have ideas that maybe you just wanted to be a private pilot, you know?
I've always wanted to focus and be an airline pilot. There was never any doubt in my mind. The other options were not big options for me. I realized that when I had my mentor at the time, I looked at his lifestyle, and it's one of these careers that doesn't demand that you be there every day and that from 9 to 5.
Right.
And to have the ability to fly somewhere and have your basically your per diems and hotels and transportation looked after, not to mention some fantastic places that I got to see or realized at the time, really solidified my choice.
We're speaking with Bruce Bornstein. It's All in a Day's Work with an airline pilot. And lots of questions. We're going to also open up the phones and emails and Twitter, but we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. It's All in a Day's Work, and we're with pilot, retired captain, Bruce Bornstein. And if you'd want to join in the conversation, if you have questions, if you're thinking about becoming a pilot, or maybe you are one, you want to talk to Bruce, 1-800-743-9576. I'm giving out. We're not there yet. I'm giving out the wrong number. It's 1-800-743-9576, radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. So, Bruce, what about simulators? How much do you train on simulators?
Okay, simulators play such a primary focus on training any of our pilots, and always have been. When we do an initial course, we do what most people understand, the ground school. Today, that's integrated classroom work with your simulators. We have different kinds where you can do classroom with a working simulator, but we have what we call your into the full flight simulator, which is completely a three-axis, very complex machine that has feel, sound, sight, and we would have to do the course and go through so many sessions to get licensed. And then recurrent training in the airlines is usually every 6 months, where we spend 2 days of a minimum four-hour sessions, as we call in the box. And we start off with our pre-briefing with our instructors, and then we have a post-briefing after. So it's a full day's work, 2 days back-to-back.
And that's the, once you are a pilot, the on-the-job training, or
yes,
the keeping up maintenance.
Yes, yeah, for licensing.
Are most instructors former pilots?
They are usually what we call line pilots, so they are actual training captains. They're
okay.
Checking captains and FAA check airmen, as we call them.
How many years between the simulator and the charter planes and all that, and how many years did it actually take you to get your license so that you could become a commercial pilot?
Since I started in my engineering course, it was 1974, and to my actual interview was 1978. So it was about 4 to 5 years, which is about average, I would say. But in that time, we didn't have the luxury of having flight simulators. No, that was a highly restrictive thing. And because of the expense and the format of training, it wasn't really a requirement at the time. So simulators are usually just designated for airlines and executive charter aircraft today, of course, too.
And does the number of hours required for a license for you as a commercial pilot differ from if you're going to be a private pilot?
Yes, it's graduated. Usually when a person starts out to get their private pilot's license, that's actually a private pilot license that has, say, I don't remember, probably 35 to 40 hours. If you take it to the next level, it's commercial pilot. So that would require more time and a little more sophisticated training involved. And then on top of that, you just keep going into instrument ratings and then multi-engine aircraft ratings. So if you're doing, If you're doing it on your own expense, it's a major undertaking.
Yeah, I would think it's pretty expensive to do all this.
It's dramatic.
Yeah.
It's dramatic. Even at the time for me, considering in the 70s, it was what it would be today, scaled back, but still the same tremendous expense required to rent aircraft.
And is the salary for a pilot good enough to kind of compensate for all that, those years of expenses?
Well, I don't know how they start off the pilots today with the airline, but I believe that they would be on flat pay for a minimum 1 to 2 years. So it's going to be some time before you can accumulate your training money back, but the reward is worth it.
You know, I was also thinking airline pilots, back when I remember, used to be kind of like rock stars, you know, and they seem to be making so much money. Do they make more, less now than they used to make?
Definitely. I guess Hollywood has made the airline pilot, profiled him as Superman,
right?
Which belongs in the movies. But our careers have, as a lot of fellas felt, have lapsed into jobs because of the cutbacks, because of the mergers, because of our present-day situation where our salaries were drastically reduced. And there's been a lot of bankruptcies, as I'm
right.
sure you're well aware of.
Sure.
So it's more or less forced to accept something that is less than what we were making before, but still very, very decent salaries.
Okay. Okay. So let's talk about the first time you flew an aircraft commercially. Were you given control of the plane?
Yes, at least. Where I worked, that's how that's how we do it. We have at the time we don't have second officers or flight engineers anymore, but I was started off as a second officer, which would be the side position. We used to call them Oilers, and we had
Oilers.
Oilers was just a little pet name we gave to the guys who sat sideways.
Okay.
And the next year after my first, after I joined, I went into the right seat or as a first officer. So when we do a trip with multiple legs, either the captain will do the first leg or the first officer. And if we continue, we rotate. We just alternate legs.
Okay. I want to get to all that. But when you do that alternate, when you alternate legs, can you go take a nap or something while they're actually in charge?
Just up until my retirement, my last probably 15 years were spent doing transoceanic and international flying, where we did long hauls of 16 hours. So our aircraft were equipped with bunks. So sometimes we take a complete complement of a full crew, which would be a relief pilot and another first officer, and we stay with one captain. So there'd be four of us because of the length of time, and we designate our sleep cycles. We just rotate.
Where are the bunks?
It depends on the airplane. On the Airbus 340 that I was flying, we had it right behind the cockpit itself. The Boeing 777s actually have it in the on the nose, on the roof. It's built in. You never know it, but it's like a beautiful little hotel room.
Really? So these are things we don't see, though.
No, you wouldn't. No, not at all.
Okay. I just want to know that first flight that you were in charge and you were the, what is it called?
Oh, the captain or the first officer?
The first officer.
Yeah.
What did that feel like to you?
I was extraordinarily nervous. I remember the flight. We were going to Chicago, and I knew that O'Hare was quite the place and quite the reputation. And
I mean, because it's so busy.
It's so busy. I was with my captain was looked like an ancient old white-haired guy, and a little intimidating, but it was very, very exciting to be able to do this.
And what's it like to know that so many lives are depending on you? Does that go through your mind?
It's an often asked question. At times, you know, we know that we bear that responsibility, but I always told myself that as long as I remain safe, I know everybody else is going to be the same. They'll be safe too.
When you were there for the first time, did anything surprise you that you've, or was there anything you felt unprepared for?
Well, as far as flying is concerned, it's a learning curve. And to adapt to the airline life, it's going to be, they say, the first year is your big learning curve just to learn the airplane. It takes a long time to understand how the airline itself operates. And I felt probably it took a good five years before it sank in that now it's a good job. But I calmed myself down a bit. But it took a long time.
Did it?
It did. So it's intimidating, but it's not for everybody.
No. Let's just talk to Nancy in Boca for a minute. Where are you, Nancy? Hi, Nancy. Welcome. Nancy?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. You're on with Bruce.
Oh, hi, Bruce. I just wanted to say hello to you. My father flew for Eastern Airlines for 40 years, and I grew up in an airline family, and I always listened to my dad's stories when he would come home from trips. He was hijacked in the 60s to Cuba, and I wanted to know if you ever flew any of your family when you were the first officer, because I rode once with my dad, and I have a funny story about that. But I wanted to know if you ever do that.
Hi, Nancy. Probably about 30 years ago, close to 30 years ago, I had my mom and dad on a flight. And it was a funny experience, a funny feeling to know that your family is with you or joining you on the flight.
It's
I'm sure your dad has some tremendous stories.
Oh, he did, and he's talked about them. He lives in an adult congregate living facility now, and he used to talk to the residents there about his funny experiences, which are many. But one time I flew with him to Los Angeles. I had a date, and he flew the Miami to L.A. flight. And on the way back, I was in first class, because I was a pass rider, and this man was bothering me, and he was kind of a not very pleasant man. And I finally said to him, you know, my father's the pilot of this plane, and I wish you would leave me alone. And he kind of laughed at me and was rude. And just then, my dad walked out of the cockpit and said, hi, honey, how you doing?
Yeah.
And the guy didn't bother me the rest of the trip. It was great.
All right, Nancy. Well, thanks so much for sharing that story.
Thank you for the show. I've enjoyed listening to you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. How did you go from being a first officer to a captain?
That requires a whole course. If I break it down, when you are on the same aircraft type, you are not required to do the airplane course, but you are required to do the upgrade course. So that involves a series of flight simulators, and then you do a pre-command simulator ride. And that involves 1 or 2 days, or actually the first one I think is the 1 day. Once that's completed, then you go out what we call line indoctrination with check captain. And then you will fly with other captains who are what we call right seat qualified. And you'll do a normal, what we call block of flying, that will take you up to so many hours or so many months until you complete, say, for argument's sake, 100 hours. And then you get another check at the end of that, and they'll determine if you're ready to do what they call the final command ride. And that's 2 days of nail biting, and it's a lot of work.
It sounds like it. Yeah. I mean, we're not talking about being a brain surgeon. You think there's a lot involved in this.
A lot of nerves, but very rewarding.
We're speaking with Bruce Bornstein. He's a retired captain, and it's All in a Day's Work on Topical Currents. A short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. It's All in a Day's Work with retired Captain Bruce Bornstein. And we do have some calls. We're jumping ahead with Eric, but it's a good question. And so we're going to take it now. Go ahead, Eric. You're on with Bruce.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. I flew the Navy in the 60s and 70s, and every aircraft I flew had the old analog instruments. I know you've seen a lot of changes in your cockpit displays. I was on a 747 400 series flying in the cockpit, and I looked up, and there are the old analog instruments. I asked the pilots, where's this come from? He says, when everything else fails, those work.
Hi,
it
Eric.
It didn't happen. I imagine that did not. That my question really was, how much training do today's pilots get on the old analog instruments?
Well, that's a great question. I started out on Boeing 727s, and they were all analog. It was nothing in the way of a digital display way before the time. The big break came, or I should say break, the big thing came with our guys on the Airbus 320 was introduced as the glass cockpit, and I'm sure you've heard that before. The transition was very, very dramatic to, I'd say, a lot of the old-timers, the fellows who were from the military, the old salty guys, because they just couldn't take to it or adapt that well. When you were in the 747-400, the only thing that you probably saw were a couple standby instruments, and there were only be only two or three of them. But you're absolutely right about that. They would be used at standby.
But may I ask another question?
Sure.
Apparently, the pilots, the two young pilots on the Air France Indus flight over the South Atlantic, did not know how to fly those instruments, and therefore the plane was stalled out because they were totally unaware of the fact the pitot tube was frozen. They still have the gyro, and they didn't know how to fly the gyro. Apparently. Do you know anything more about that?
Actually, I have no knowledge of it. I believe I know what you're referring to, but in a sense, you're right, is that today's modern pilot who is flying glass are not given enough hands-on training, and that's mentioned quite often in the media. It's more than likely due to training costs, but they encourage all of us today to use complete use of automation. And that would be slightly, right after takeoff when the landing gear is retracted, we put on the autopilot and it doesn't come off till 20 seconds before we land. So in effect, a lot of fellows have become, I hate to say it, afraid to take control. But nevertheless, you know, you'd have to go back to your initial training, which demands that you know how to fly and how to keep yourself operated.
Wow. Well, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Okay, thanks for calling. We're jumping all over the place, but just because of that, what about that? I'm sure you heard about the Captain Sully making that emergency landing on the Hudson. How would you have handled that the same way? Did you ever think that? Did you think to yourself, how would I have handled that?
Oh, I think all of us did. I spent a long time in that airplane on the Airbus, the 320. By all accounts, even to the novice and to the professional, it was an incredible feat because we only could simulate and predict what would happen, figuring that the aircraft would break up on impact.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he was able to do it, perform this so well, and the airplane actually stayed afloat was absolutely remarkable. The only problem, maybe the worst thing that happened, is exposure in the frozen water.
Right. And I just, S. Pulley has sent a tweet that you can see the crew beds on an Airbus 340 and hear the show now on WLRN, and gives a link if you want to see those, I guess, the crew beds.
Oh,
somebody posted that, so they did a picture of it and tweeted it.
Oh, fine.
Yeah. Also, what was your typical shift?
Are you referring to when we're on a day's flight, like on duty?
Yes.
Typical flight, say I did quite a bit of flying to Hong Kong, and these were about 14-hour, 15-hour flights. We would have normally four of us in the cockpit. All four are there for the takeoff. Our relief pilot would we'd have him draw up the sleep time. So he'll make the schedule. So we just spell each other off, but the operating crew does the takeoff and the landing.
Okay, so let's get back to a typical day. You have a flight scheduled. How many hours before a flight do you begin your day?
They say to be there 1 hour before for a briefing. I felt that was not enough time because there's always incidents and other contingencies to deal with. So an hour before, if the flight was for 8 in the morning, you'd be there at 7 and no later.
But you were there earlier.
I made it a point to get there because I always know that there's more to do. If there's weather, there's issues, there's air traffic control problems, there's anything that
whatever contingency.
I felt I needed more time.
And how are your routes assigned? Is that a matter of seniority?
Yes, Bonnie. Actually, it is. We have what we call, when we do flights, we typically call them pairings. That's where you start and where you finish in so many days. You can do one day, one flight. You can do four flights in a day, or you can do a long haul that will be 4 days. So these pairings are put into a schedule, and we call them blocks. And what we do is we bid on these blocks. Or today we have computer bidding.
Oh.
So now we can mix and match and hope for the best according to your seniority. So we make many choices, and they post the results usually a week before the end of the month.
So is it a certain point that you get to that you choose your own route, or it's always you having to go into this pairing?
You do get to choose, and if you have decent seniority, you can usually get an awful lot of what you like. And some pilots like to be home weekends. Some like to go to the destinations, and some like the per diems, and they like the expenses.
Okay. So. What point do you meet the flight crew? Do you choose your flight crew, or is it assigned?
It's usually assigned because we, as individuals, bid as your position, you bid on your flight. So you don't really know who you're working with other than on paper. You can find out, oh, I'm with this person, this person, this person. But that can always change because of book-offs and because of we've got a change in schedule. Mm-hmm. So that's how that happens.
So it's not that you usually fly with the same crew. That's not the way it's set up.
No, not anymore. You're always with usually different people. The old days, we had what we called the canned blocks, where you were with the same people all month long. That could be a good thing, and it may not be such a good thing.
How is that relationship with the flight crew?
I had never really any problems. Most everybody is fabulous that I worked with. I just felt it was always fun to go to work. There would be some different personality conflicts, but everybody had a job to perform, and it was just like you have to know the lines that you're given, and this is we go by the book, so we know what everybody's supposed to do. And but personality is something you adapt to.
Well, I guess it's like with anything.
Right? It is.
Okay, so before you get on the plane, actually, before anybody boards the plane, do you have a checklist that you go through before you even go and check the fuel and the tires and all those things?
We have our electronic flight plan that we check in the office. So we do all our fuel checking there. And we make our changes there. So if we feel that there's a typhoon moving over the Pacific, our dispatcher, we would pick up the phone and say, look, what do you think? We confer with him. We'd like another 5,000 pounds of fuel if we can carry it. And usually they're very cooperative. So we do everything there, but our actual checklists take place once we're in our seats.
Okay, so take us through the checklist once you're in the seat.
Walking on board the airplane, we usually introduce ourselves to our flight attendants who will be there at the time. We have the in charge, who's their captain. So we exchange information. I give them the flight time, the destination, weather, and any contingencies or anything they need to know. When we're seated, we have a systematic ramp check to go through. And we don't normally have to look at the book for that because we're trained in such a way that we perform scans. And the procedure that takes most of the time is loading up our computers. So we take the electronic flight plan and we put things like our routing in there, our fuel, our meteorological winds and temperatures. The computer figures out the best time track or the best options for us to make the flight as economical as possible.
Is there anything on that list that would surprise us?
I can't recall anything that would be out of the ordinary. I know that everybody likes to know about the black boxes, but what those are buried internally in all airplanes. But the pickups, there's two things we're talking about. One is the cockpit voice recorder, which usually goes on in some airplanes when we turn our beacons on. It picks up our voices, and everything is digitally recorded in these boxes below. Every asset, it's like an EKG that's constantly going.
Really? That's a little surprising.
So if there's any reason that they have to pull them, for any reason, it doesn't have to be a major catastrophe. Sometimes the maintenance people actually have to go through it to troubleshoot a problem, say it be an engine issue, a flight control issue. They can do that. And today's airplanes are equipped. They're so far advanced, they can track us anywhere in the world and read us just like a graph sitting at your home computer. And they can punch in exactly what they want to see. So if there's a spike in an instrument, there's a spike in an engine that triggers a bit of a caution on their panel, they can see it and call us.
And who will be the person seeing that?
Well, we normally will have a first reference to any abnormal condition.
Right, right.
I'm talking about today's Airbuses that have the ability to communicate at all times silently with our maintenance people is usually one center, and they can actually ping us wherever we are.
We're speaking with Bruce Bornstein, All in a Day's Work. The life of a retired, now retired, former airline captain. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for being with us. We're speaking with retired Captain Bruce Bornstein, and it's All in a Day's Work. It's our new series, and we are really happy to have you with us. Are there ever occasions or problems during boarding that require your presence, or is that solely the responsibility of the crew?
Usually, the flight attendants look after all the contingencies. If there's seat duplications, or there's special needs, handicapped, or we have a medical issue where somebody's on oxygen, we need to know, because anything that has any medical assistance, such as oxygen bottles, have to be placed at a certain. Some passengers have to be seated at a certain place or a certain seat. But normally, we have nothing to do with any of the boarding.
What do you mean if they have oxygen, they need to be in a certain place or a certain
seat? Now it's been a while, but if we have somebody who has suffering from emphysema, and they have to be on full-time oxygen, probably today's requirements, they might have to have an escort with them, or we just have to know where they're sitting and what their requirements are. We also service animals today. That's been also greatly accepted, widely accepted, where in the old days it wasn't such a thing we could do.
Yeah, and it's much more common now, isn't
it? Yes, it is. Yeah.
And okay, before we take off, well, let's go through the takeoff procedure. Is that largely automated too?
No, this is the one portion of the flight that is pretty well in control of whoever is handling the controls. Once the aircraft is lined up on the runway, and we've been given our clearance for takeoff, what happens is, if it's the first officer doing the takeoff, he will be in complete control. He will advance the throttles. He will steer the aircraft, and he accelerates and does the takeoff. But at some point where we have our speed reference, where it's what we call the abort speed, go, no go, if we have to do a rejected takeoff due to any major mishap, like an engine failure, then the captain would immediately take over and he does his procedure. And what we do is part of our checks after we're complete our cockpit checks is that we run through our drills. And that means that it's all from memory. The captain will start off by saying every word has to be the same, and the first officer says, I will. The captain says, I will do, I will do, I will do.
Hmm.
So at that point, everything is done manually.
So that's right before takeoff.
Well, before but after. The drills are done before. They don't have to be done through every takeoff. It's just once the crew is, the first time they get together, we understand each other.
Henry has a question. Quickly, we'll take Henry because we're getting near the end of the show and we haven't even gotten to 9/11 yet and we have a lot to go through. So, okay, Henry, welcome.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Henry.
Hi, thank you for taking some time out. I guess on a side note, I was thinking about my quick questions. Automatic pilots are worthless during takeoff as well as landing, correct? And my second quick question is, how has deregulation modified age requirement in the commercial airline industry? I think deregulation, I come from a family, my dad worked for National and then Pan American. Mm-hmm. So I've seen quite a bit, a humongous change in the industry of airlines. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that from your experience, and I wish you the best of luck, and thank you for your time.
Oh, you're
okay,
welcome.
Thank you, Henry.
To answer your first question regarding autopilots, are they worthless? Well, absolutely not. We constantly rely on them. If you can imagine that if we have a 15-hour flight ahead of us, if we didn't have an autopilot, having the burden of the person who's in control and flying has to constantly manipulate the airplane, and that's very, very fatiguing. So we usually use that at all times. It's encouraged, and it navigates. It does a much better job than a human will do. As for landings, we usually have it programmed for our destinations. We always use it, and I'd say 95% of the time. But if the weather requirements don't demand it, we will manually land the airplane. In other words, we will disconnect it about maybe 60 seconds before we do the touchdown. As we say, that's the most fun part of the flying for us.
Is it?
Well, it's landings are always a challenge. It's always a different place, a different time of day. It's a different country.
What makes it more difficult? What makes it easier?
Weather, traffic, language. When you're tired and you're listening to a foreign language and you're trying to understand it. And
you mean from the air traffic control?
Air traffic control. And, of course, your winds play a big role,
right,
in how we're going to do our landings, because two landings are never quite the same.
When you say language, that's a little bit surprising to me. So you don't have to speak the same language as the tower?
Well, air traffic controllers, they do speak English. It's always been that way. But when I say English, it's sometimes very challenging to have to try and your best to listen to a heavy accent.
But are they all required to speak English?
Yes, they are. Yes. Some countries will talk very briefly to other pilots of the same language, but when it comes to most of the pilots, English, they must talk English with you.
Bruce, we have so little time left and so many more questions and calls and emails and tweets. Do you miss flying?
I've been asked that a lot. I do. I miss the camaraderie. I miss our destinations. I like to see the guys and get in on it. But the job is fun. It's a lot of maintenance. It's very lucky to be able to hold on to a job like this, especially in times like today.
Where were you on 9/11?
Actually, I remember that. I was on my way to Hong Kong. And when this actually took place, we were over Russian airspace. And I believe I was on my break. And when I came back, it was 30 minutes before landing. It was dark. And the flight deck was very quiet. I got in the seat. And then I had a whole bunch of messages that we have data machines that will give us everything we need. And there were some messages on there where I'll never forget as to what was going on. When we landed in Hong Kong, it was very, very quiet. So we didn't really know the news officially until we taxied in.
So you didn't know exactly what was going on
not
until
at all.
You landed?
No, not really.
Did it change for you after 9/11? Did being a pilot change for you?
The whole job took on a different perspective. No more of the open cockpit doors, no more visitors. Because we're human, the flight going back, I remember to Hong Kong, had double or triple security procedures for everybody. No knives, no forks. Everything was almost so styrofoam and cardboard. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't allow any corkscrews. Nothing was allowed. We weren't even allowed to leave the cockpit. And even then, we're getting messages from our chief pilots as to how our procedures are going to be. We just can't walk out and do what we want anymore.
Right.
So it's just become an unfriendly kind of a situation, but we understand that this is the way we have to do it now.
Well, just last question, and we missed taxiing, really. We didn't talk about that or the actual flight and a little about landing, but would you recommend that someone pursue that career now?
Well, absolutely. But you can't take it anything but serious. You go all the way. It's a big challenge. There's a lot of drawbacks. There'll be times where you're really flat out, you feel you'll never make it. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't. But
you mean because it's so rigorous?
Because it's rigorous. It's expensive. There's no guarantee. You just can't get onto the airline anymore straight into it. You have to go onto their feeder lines first. In my day, I didn't have that. Everything happened after deregulation. I believe you asked that before. So it's going to be a while now. And I was 23 at the time. The average age is probably mid-30s for a pilot to make it with the airline.
Well, we've run out of time, Bruce. I think I'm going to invite you back. We're going to do part two of this since we didn't get to enough on part one. That is our program for today. Thank you, Bruce Bornstein, for being with us.
Thank you very much, Bon. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives. Today's program was produced by Peter J. Meritz with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. And more information, links, photos at WLRN.org and Topical Currents Facebook page. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a very good one. We'll see you tomorrow. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.